Well, if you have your Bibles, I invite you to turn with me to 1 Kings chapter 18. I'm glad you're here for Father's Day 2020. We're going to continue in our study in the life of Elijah. And I think that there's a special message for dads in particular in this story. We've been trying to get a glimpse of the awesomeness of the power of God in our own lives in the same way that Elijah experienced. The next 2 weeks, we're going to look at 1 Kings chapter 18, one of the most famous stories in the whole Old Testament. We're going to focus in on one key verse today, just verse 21. We'll read a few verses around that. And then next week, we'll talk about the whole awesome story of Elijah and the prophets of Baal on the top of Mount Carmel. We'll just introduce it here this morning as we get started. So I want to talk about this idea of no fence sitting allowed. And that's the picture. In fact, that's the title, no fence sitting allowed, out of 1 Kings 18, 21. Are you familiar with that term? It's an idiom, a word picture. In fact, I looked up the definition. And it means, or the definition of this idiom is the idea to be undecided or refusing to choose a side. Sort of the idea that, you know, you're sitting on the fence. If you step off the fence on one side, you're heading in one direction. If you step off the fence on the other side, you're heading in a different direction. And you're having a hard time choosing, and so you're sitting on the fence. The illustration on Google that I saw was the example to explain this was the kids wanted a dog and his wife wanted a cat, and Jack was sitting on the fence over the issue. No matter which he chose, it wasn't going to make life easy for him. All right, so that's what sitting on the fence means. Not sure which way to go. It reminds me of the marriage compromise story where the young man said, my wife wanted a puppy. I didn't want a puppy, so we compromised and we got a puppy, right? That's what compromise means in marriage. Really, this term is interesting. Actually, I'll give you a little history of this term. It came in the 1800s, started to be used pretty commonly, became a more popular phrase, especially when discussing political matters. This visual of hopping down on one side or the other of the fence, taking you in one direction or the other. The most famous political fence sitters were the Mugwumps. This is actually true. In the 1880s, in 1884, there was a group of Republicans who decided that they were going to vote for the Democratic candidate in the election of 1884, and their opponents started calling them Mugwumps. Mugwumps was actually a term that's from the Algonquin Indians, and it just means important person. So there was this term that was taken from the Algonquins, this important person, but that's not how it was being used as defined what these Republicans who were voting Democratic. They were using the term more derisively. And because what they were saying is they're like birds sitting on their fence, on the fence. They're mugs on one side and they're wumps on the other. I mean, that's really what they said. They were the Mugwumps. And 1884, you can look it up. The most famous fence sitters. The reason that we're talking about this, the sitting on the fence idea, is I think that it's very easy for some Christians to settle into this kind of half-hearted Christian life. So the Bible is repeatedly calling us, and it's repeatedly challenging us to decide, to determine, to not sit on the fence. It's repeatedly encouraging us to be all in for Christ and for following God. No man can serve two masters, Matthew 6:24 says. For either he will hate the one and love the other, or hold to one and despise the other. This is talking about money, but it's really this idea, get on one side or the other. You can't serve two masters. The book of James says it very strongly. He says, ye adulterers and adulteresses, All right, very strong calling out language about unfaithfulness, talking to Christians. He says, know ye not that the friendship with the world is enmity with God. Whosoever will be a friend of the world is the enemy of God. In 1 John chapter 2, verse 15, John the apostle says, love not the world, neither the things that are in the world. If any man love the world, the love of the Father is not in him. And we could come up with many, many verses all throughout the Bible that are challenging us and calling us to not be fence sitters. You got to decide whose team and whose side, and you got to determine whether you're going to be all in. Here's how it looked in the Old Testament. That's really the story that we're coming to in 1 Kings 18. We're going to pick up the story in verse 17. Actually, there's a very funny introduction to this story, and I'm not going to read the first 16 verses, but if you're tracking along with this series, Elijah is in hiding, remember, first at the brook Cherith, and then with the widow of Zarephath, all in chapter 17, for 3 years now. And according to verse 10, King Ahab has been searching everywhere for the prophet Elijah, and he cannot find him. I mean, he's spent 3 years searching high and low in his effort to locate bring, you know, Elijah in and have a talk with him. He can't find him. Now in chapter 18, God tells Elijah, I'm going to bring the rains. It's been 3 years. I'm going to bring the rains, and I want you to go, and I want you to tell King Ahab. So Elijah heads out. He's on his way to find King Ahab. And as he is on his way, he meets Obadiah. We're introduced to this man named Obadiah. Obadiah was one of the trusted governors in King Ahab's court. In fact, it tells us this little story. I mean, they had nothing. The drought was severe in the land. And so King Ahab had sent his trusted governor, Obadiah, and they split up, and they were going to go throughout all the land to try to find any place where they could feed their livestock. So that's the task that Obadiah was on, the king's task, to go find some water or, you know, some grass where they could, keep his livestock alive. And on the way, he meets Elijah. And Elijah says to him, hey, listen, I want you to go tell King Ahab that I'm here, that I'd like to meet him. And here's kind of the funny part of the story. Obadiah says, Obadiah is a believer in God. He was a faithful to God, even in some difficult circumstances. Oh, and Obadiah says to him, why do you hate me? Because I know what's going to happen. We've been looking for you for 3 years. We've searched every single crevice, every single valley in this whole land, and we can't find you. Obviously, I think there maybe been a reputation that was growing that God was hiding Elijah. He said, if I go tell King Ahab that you're here, and I bring Ahab back, in the meantime, the angel of the Lord is going to pick you up, and he's going to move you so that when I come back with King Ahab, you're not going to be here anyway, and the king's going to kill me. Why do you hate me so much? And Elijah says, no, you go tell King Ahab, I'll be here when you get back. That's where we're going to pick up the story in verse 17. And it came to pass, when Ahab saw Elijah, that Ahab said unto him, art thou he that troubleth Israel? And we have Elijah's reputation coming through here in verse 18. Elijah answers, I have not troubled Israel, but thou and thy father's house, in that ye have forsaken the commandments of the Lord, and thou hast followed Balaam. Now therefore send and gather to me all Israel unto Mount Carmel, and the prophets of Baal 450, and the prophets of the groves 400, which eat at Jezebel's table. So Ahab sent unto all the children of Israel, and gathered the prophets together unto Mount Carmel. We're going to read verse 21 in just a minute. All right, so now we've got Elijah on the top of Mount Carmel, and he tells Ahab to go get 850 of the prophets of Baal. Actually, 450 prophets of Baal, and then 400 prophets to the goddess Asherah. These are the ones that Jezebel was worshiping, Baal and Asherah. 850 strong, he says, I want you to bring them to the top of Mount Carmel along with all of the people. And now standing on the top of the mount, looking out over the people. In fact, maybe I can give you a little bit of a background of what we sort of see of the people in front of them. This was a convenient place for the nation of Israel. They are sitting on the fence, and they like it. Jehovah is the God of Israel. He was central to their government. He's central to their history. The Israelites would have said, "We are children of Jehovah." They could look back. There's memorials all throughout the land of what God, Jehovah, had done for them. But over time, obedience to Jehovah had become a little bit of a burden for the Israelites. And in fact, they grew attracted to some of the worship of the other gods. And so really, the Israelites, at the time that Elijah's going to talk to them here, at the time of this drought, they were sort of in a convenient place for them, physically, because they could kind of do what they wanted. They weren't having to hold up the standards of the God of Jehovah, the Mosaic law. They didn't have to live by that. They can kind of do what they want, but then when anything bad happened, they could fall back on Jehovah God who had provided for them. I don't know if that sounds familiar at all to you. A foundation of belief in God, maybe of a people that believed in God, yet the reason or the challenge to live faithful to God kind of becomes a difficulty, and so people have walked away in sort of a convenient place. And it's to these people that Elijah addresses his very short challenge in verse 21. And Elijah came unto all the people and said, "How long halt ye between two opinions? If the Lord be God, follow him. But if Baal, then follow him." And the people answered him not a word. I mean, he looks the Israelites straight in the eyes and he says, "Look, I'm not pulling any punches. I don't have time to beat around the bush. It's either God or your idols. There's no middle ground. There's no other choices. You decide." I think Elijah's challenge boils down to two very, very important questions. And these are just very simply, I'm going to lay this out before you this morning. Question number one is, who will you serve? And question number two is, when will you decide? Very pointed, very clear. One of the most powerful, logical, and effective sermons of all time, Elijah challenges the nation of Israel to this total surrender to God. He says, "How long halt you between two opinions? If the Lord be God, follow him. But if Baal, then follow him." I mean, that's it. Elijah simply asks a logical, pointed, cut straight to the heart, convicting questions. Who are you going to serve? Listen, it's very, very important to know this, that everybody has to live for something. Everybody has to live for something, and whatever that something is will eventually enslave you. And I want to talk about that just for a minute. Everybody has to live for something, and whatever that something is will eventually enslave you. It is the real cycle of life. We hear terms like the circle of life, right? That's out of The Lion King. That's the circle of life. That's not what I'm talking about. This is, I think, really the cycle of life. And it's the reason why everybody at some point feels unfulfilled. Everybody. Because we have to serve something. We're wired in this way. And that something, whatever we give ourselves to, eventually leaves us unfulfilled. And there's always, always, always a desire for more. So if you live for, here's kind of the equation you should put in our minds. If you live for blank, then eventually you will become a slave of blank. Let me kind of talk with you how that works out. If you live for something, you eventually become a slave of something. If you live for work, the problem is that work never satisfies you. If this is what you're living for, if this is the God, and I don't know that I know anybody that comes out and just says it, but I think I know a lot of people that that's the reality. If you live for work, you will never, it will never fully satisfy you. It can't. And so all it does is it asks for more. This is the cycle of life. More work and more work and more work, but it never satisfies and you become a slave to it. If you live for your physical appearance, your figure, your physique, if you live for that, there's always more and more and more, but it never satisfies. And we become slaves to what we're living for. If you live for pleasure, if you live for entertainment, if you live for video games, if you live for sports teams, if you live for something, whatever you live for always demands and asks for more. It's never satisfied, and eventually we become a slave of whatever we live for. So what happens, listen, is that you either come to the point of believing that life was just meant to be unfulfilling, or you come to believe that we were meant for something else. Does that make sense? I've just talked with way too many people to not come up with this philosophy, because it happens over and over and over again. No matter what you live for, ultimately becomes unfulfilling. And you either have to come to the point, whether, you know, that's people that you talk to in their 30s or 40s or 60s or 80s, you either have to come to the point that says, you know what, life is just unfulfilling. Or we come to the point where we realize that we were meant for something else, and anything else besides God will leave us unfulfilled. Does that make sense? So the question that Elijah's asking is who you're going to serve. It's very clear. He's saying there's no fence sitting allowed. There's only two options. You're either going to choose to serve God with your whole heart, give him every aspect of your life, or you're going to serve yourself. I think it was Ken Collier that said there's two choices on the shelf, serving God or pleasing God or pleasing self. This is true. You can't sit on the fence. We're either going to choose to serve God or we're going to end up serving ourselves. The decision that Elijah confronts us with today, I think, involves at least three points. If I can just mention these three things. Number one, it's a logical decision. I mean, he really just says it this way. He says, listen, if the Lord is God, follow him. I mean, if this is Jehovah God, follow him. If Baal is God, then follow him. And it just makes sense. Let's determine who God is, and then whoever it is, it's logical that you would follow him. If God is real, if the Bible is true, I mean, it says a lot about life, and it says a lot about direction, and we better serve him. And if it's not, then Elijah says that, then go serve something else. Don't waste your time serving a God that's not real and true. I mean, but you can't sit on the fence kind of saying, okay, I believe in God, but I'm just going to kind of not really serve him. It's inconsistent with anything that the Bible says about itself. So God's not asking for us to do something illogical. It's a logical decision. It's a personal decision. No one can make this decision for you. Not your family, not your husband or wife. They can't make it for you. Young people, your parents can make you come to church, but they don't decide who you will serve. I'm not even talking about down the road. I'm talking about right now. I'm not even saying, you know, for right now, you're kind of got to be a Christian because you're part of your parents' house. You're going to decide eventually who you're going to serve. I mean right now. Your parents can ask you or make you to come to church, but right now you're deciding who you're going to serve. Adults, family pressure or maybe even some sort of church guilt can push you to come to church or push you to behave in a certain way. But listen, you alone decide who you're going to serve. All right? It is a personal decision, and it's a daily decision. I mean, as you study through the history of Israel, and I don't have the time to go back to this, but you find that it parallels the trials and the experiences of most Christians. Israel, just like many Christians, had this tendency to lose their focus, and the result was always these terrible consequences. I mean, read through Judges. We're going to see it here in the book of, we saw it in 1 and 2 Samuel, 1 and 2 Kings. Chronicles talks about the same thing, all right? I mean, they lost their focus, drifted away from God, and always it ended up with hard consequences in their lives. If they did not continually commit themselves to serving God, they found that rebellion crept in, and it always led to distance from God, and it led to serving other gods, and ultimately, you know, God's correction in their lives. There's a very natural tendency for us to serve ourselves. And I'm convinced that the Christian who's truly committed to giving God first place in life is going to have to daily answer this question: who will I serve today? I mean, who am I going to serve today? What's my choice going to be today? Men, I told you, I think there's a specific lesson for you, for us here from this story, and fathers in particular. I want to encourage you that you carry a special responsibility. You carry a special weight about this, and about not just you personally, but what your example is going to do for your family, and ultimately what your example and then your family's example does for a culture. Men, we carry a very special weight. I was reading a poll, a 2018 poll, which talked about, the question is, which TV dad do you wish was your own? And it was really interesting. I think there was 40,000 responses to this poll answering this question: which TV dad was your own? And it was only 2 years ago. There was a variety of ages. So they asked this from, you know, a younger generation all up to, you know, an older generation. But of the 40,000, I don't know how those ages broke down. But this was interesting. They listed about 20 of these father figures, TV dads that you thought would be your own. The really interesting thing about it is the top five, a bunch of you probably don't even know who they are. Here they were: Sheriff Andy Taylor, Andy Griffith Show, Pa Ingalls, Little House on the Prairie, Howard Cunningham, Happy Days, Ward Cleaver, Leave It to Beaver, and Jim Anderson, Father Knows Best, and then number six was Mike Brady from the Brady Bunch. Most of you guys are like, these are before me, right? And I got some ages on me. And it's kind of some interesting things about this poll, but it made me think about a couple things. The first is the question: where are the father figures today? I don't watch a lot of TV, so maybe they're out there. But this poll was including not just an old generation, and what it said to me kind of statistically is the only group that could come up with enough names were people that were from an older generation that had watched some shows back in the past, because a younger generation can't come up with a name, or at least enough names that everybody would say enough that would show up on the poll. So where are the father role models? I mean, nobody's watching Little House on the Prairie. Maybe Andy Griffith Show. Anybody still watch Andy Griffith Show? It comes back on. I've got a friend that's like a Andy Griffith Show fan, super fan. But the other thing that it says about these role models is just this reminder, dads, that your kids are not looking for super cool, hip. They just want somebody. I mean, these characters, they're consistent, they're stable, they're full of integrity, and they love their families. Who's the one Tim Taylor showed up, Home Improvements, that's number 7. And Philip Banks was number 10, Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. Even now, every generation, when we look at the ideal fathers, it's just stable, full of character, consistent. Let me tell you this, dads. You are primarily responsible for the spiritual leadership of your home. And every chance I get, I want to come along beside you, not chiding you, not chastising you. I want to walk beside you, and I want to encourage you in this area. Dads, do not abandon your role. Do not abandon your post. I listened to a talk recently about fathers and dads, and according to this speaker, he said this: every man's greatest fear, and then every man's greatest pain. According to this guy, every man's greatest fear is failure, and every man's greatest pain is regret. And man, I want to come alongside young dads, young fathers, fathers with kids in middle school and high school. And I don't think it's ever too late, dads. I don't think you should ever feel like it's too late. But I want to come by beside you every chance I get and say, do not live to regret your choices. Don't disengage. Don't abandon your post. You do not want to live and someday die with regrets. And how are you going to do that? Well, you're going to have to stand in your role. You're going to have to stand in your post. Turn with me back real quick to Joshua chapter 24. Joshua 24 is maybe one of the best examples of it. And it connects very specifically with this story. I don't have time to read the whole thing. Actually, verses 14 through 28 gives this great challenge from Joshua, I think specifically to men. But look at verse 14. It says, "Now therefore fear the Lord and serve him in sincerity and in truth." That's what we're talking about. Who are you going to serve? Serve him. And do it in sincerity. Listen, every single person in your family is going to see through any bit that's fake. It's going to have to be real. Serve him in sincerity and in truth. And then he says, put away the gods which your fathers served on the other side of the flood and in Egypt, and serve ye the Lord. Serve God. Put away the other gods. Don't let anything else become an idol that's going to consume your affections. In verse 15, and if it seem evil, if it seems undesirable to you, this is what Joshua says, if it's not enough to serve the Lord, then choose you this day whom you will serve, whether the gods which your fathers served that were on the other side of the flood or the gods of the Amorites in whose land you dwell. Listen, he says, look around. You can find other gods. There's some that we left back in Egypt, and there's some in the people that of the land that we're in. You can find other gods. They're all around you. If it's not enough to give your life to God Jehovah, you can find other gods. But as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. Hey, dads, men, we need some guys that are going to stand up and are going to just make this their anthem. As for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. You're going to have to step up to the plate and determine that the kind of example that you're going to set for your family is a dad who stays. When hard times come, when you're discouraged, when life is heavy, don't back down. Don't walk away. If your marriage is struggling, don't run. Don't cower. Don't flee. Week after week, month after month, year after year, you just keep showing up and you keep standing your ground. Step out of your fears of failure. Step into the battle and be faithful. Who are you going to serve? Elijah's second critical question is, when will you decide? He says, how long, halty between two opinions. You can almost sense Elijah's frustration. He's like, man, it's taken 3 years to make this decision. God has brought a famine into our land. Our people are dying. Our land is collapsing. Our economy is dying. When are you going to turn back to God? How long are you going to sit on the fence? How long stand you between these two opinions? You've got to decide. If the Lord is Lord, follow him. If Baal is God, follow him. But don't sit on the fence. Stop sitting on the fence. It's a simple choice. No in-between options. When will you decide? I think it's a critical question for a couple of reasons. Number one, it's a very, very important question because while you wait, you're wasting time you can never get back. Men, fathers, mothers, young people, while you wait, while you sit on the fence, you're wasting time that you will never get back. The habits that you're making while fence sitting are very difficult to break. The decisions that you're making, there are always consequences. We can choose the path, but we can never choose the consequences of that path. The New Testament tells us that our lives are like vapors. We've been confronted with this again this morning. Our lives are like vapors. They appear for a little while, and then they vanish away. You only have so much time. It might seem like a long time. I've lived, 50 years now, 52 years now, and it's gone fast, and I feel like, man, I got a long, long ways to go, but man, I know the last 50 years have gone like that. You're like, man, I'm 16 years old. This is like forever. I'm 18 years old. I'm 25. Your life is like a vapor. And while you wait, you're wasting time. You can never get back. And can I also tell you that while you wait, you may lose your opportunity? It's never easy, for me at least, to preach or to say things like this, what I'm going to tell you. I wish I could stand here this morning and say that God's going to forever keep calling you to get off the fence. I know this. I know this. Before God, I stand before you this morning, and I'll tell you this. God is calling some of you to get off the fence. What I don't know is how long he'll keep calling you. If God is speaking to your heart this morning, if he's calling you to give up your life and totally sell out to him, I can't promise that he'll speak again next week. If you say no today, it'll be easier to say no again next week. Perhaps for you, God's been speaking to you for a month or months or a year. And while you wait, you're losing opportunities that you would have to give to him. You say, Pastor Gary, what does it look like? I mean, you say I'm on the fence. God says I'm on the fence. I want to get off on God's side, but I don't really know what it looks like. It's kind of an unfair question I ask myself to ask you, because I'm going to tell you this. If I had another 20 minutes or 30 minutes, I could maybe give you a little bit of an idea of what it might look like. I don't think it's like indecisive what it is, but I actually want to tell you this. It doesn't matter. It really doesn't. God is saying, I want you to follow me. And if you follow me, I'm going to give you the next steps just one at a time, one at a time. And sometimes I'm not going to give you steps 2, 3, and 4 in front of you. You're just going to have to decide whether you're going to follow him. It's sort of like Jesus walking out to his disciples, and all he said is, I'm going to make you fishers of men. Follow me. The point is really that you don't need to know He just says, follow. You know, over the years, my observation, let me tell you what happens when God speaks and you say, I'm just not ready to make that decision yet. What happens is that it's easier to say no the next time God speaks to you. And as God continues to speak and you continue to say no, and some of you know exactly what I'm talking about, you may have experienced it already, you may have been experiencing it right now. Each time we say no, it's a little bit easier the next time. There may have been a time, and you can look back a month ago or 6 months ago or 2 years ago, where as God was grabbing your heart and pulling you towards Him and pulling you off the fence, and for whatever reason during that time, you said no. And you found out that over time it becomes a little bit easier and a little bit easier. And God continues to speak. And as you continue to refuse, your conscience gets sort of seared. And you become oblivious to the Holy Spirit's conviction in your life. And the result is you never change and you never grow. And so finally you get tired of the guilt and you distance yourself from the speaking of God's voice. I've watched this happen too many times to tell you. You either just keep coming to the places where you're going to hear God's voice, but you just tune it out because it's become your routine, or you flee from the place where you're going to hear God's voice because the guilt is too intense. You need distance. The fact is, you guys, there are no guarantees that you'll get another opportunity to decide for total commitment to God. And this is what Elijah's saying. He says, how long are you going to wait? When will you decide? If God is God, give Him your life. It makes sense. Why would you not? If He's not, then go on your merry way, but you can't stay on the fence. I'm going to ask Lisa if she'd come forward for music as we close out our service. Can I just tell you a couple of things before I'm going to pray? I think there are three types of people here this morning. It's true every week. There are some here this morning, and the Bible would describe you in this way, that you've received a spiritual birth. The Bible talks about this second birth, a spiritual birth. It comes when we put our faith and trust completely in Jesus Christ as our forgiver and our leader. There's a point in time when every person has to come to that point when we say, okay, I believe, I give you my heart, my life, I accept your forgiveness for my sins. I want to be a part of your family. The Bible says that for every one of us, there's a point in time when we have to come to that spot. It might be for some here this morning, you've been on that fence. You've known that I need to make that decision formally to give my heart and seek God's forgiveness and get on His path. So it may be for some that you've not made that commitment to God to give Him first place in your life. That's one category. Some, I'm sure, that are here, and you have made that commitment to give God first place in your life, and you know, you have really put Him in its rightful place, and as you sit here this morning, you would really sense God's blessing. There's peace in your life. I think there's probably a lot of people here that would say that. Not that nobody's perfect, believe me. We know that. I hope nobody walks into Harvest thinking anybody's perfect. We're all sinners saved by grace. It's not like that. But you would say, as God's prompting me, I'm trying to listen and respond to Him, and there's a peace in my life of my future and my direction. That's category two. Category three is this. There are some here that you are a genuine Christian. There has been a time in your life when you've given your heart to Jesus, but for whatever reason, at this stage in life, you know that you've been kind of on the fence as far as following, obeying Him. And if that's true, then this morning, you're not content. there's a little bit of uneasiness. You sense that call of God that he's wanting more because he is. He sort of slipped off that priority place in your life. For you, I think you are probably the one this text is most geared for. I think to you, Elijah calls out and says, how long are you going to stay on the fence? Give your life to God. Serve him with your heart. Do it every day. Say no to the idols that are just leaving you unfulfilled and trapped. And say yes to a life of obedience to Jesus. I hope that you'll do that this morning.